broadcasting from Gallifrey, where our sheds are bigger on the inside. It's The Lonely TARDIS, Episode 4. I'm your host, Dally Domofsky. Joining me as usual, Sean Norton.
Hello.
Steven Strom.
Truth.
And weighing in at a brisk 182 pounds, Michael Bachman.
That's not true at all.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Weighing in at a brisk 382 pounds, Michael Bachman.
Thank you.
That was radio voice that for no reason I started using it all of a sudden. Anyways, welcome everybody to episode 4 of The Lonely TARDIS. If you're listening to this on the old feed, you may want to switch to the new feed, which you can find in the post. We now have our own feed for the podcast, so we did it. We grew up. We became our own show. Yay!
Hey.
Anyways, welcome everybody. Welcome, Michael, your very first Lonely TARDIS. You've been trying to get on since before the first episode, I think.
Yeah, as soon as I heard about it. So excited.
Yes, and we've been getting some really good comments from folks who are listening. So I do want to mention, everybody, if you want to get a hold of us, maybe send us a comment or an email or question, feel free to email us, lonelytardis@sidequesting.com. Again, lonelytardis@sidequesting.com. Not the Lonely TARDIS, just lonelytardis@sidequesting.com. We will try to answer everything we can on the show. Yeah, there you go. TLT. Try to answer everything on the show that we can. So hopefully you guys are well rested and ready to chat about Doctor Who, because it has been quite a couple weeks here. We obviously last week talked about the mid-season opener, and this week we had our second episode, which just aired a few days ago. So I'm really excited to kind of talk about that. But I want to talk to Michael just briefly to kind of find out how he got into Doctor Who. This is what we do every episode now. We kind of get a vibe for how people got into Doctor Who. So Michael, how did you get into Doctor Who? Tell us.
It started probably like a lot of people. It started through Netflix, just looking for things to watch. And I saw it as kind of one of those, like, you know how there's always those like hidden gems in Netflix that are just awful. And it looked like that to me because I'd never heard of Doctor Who and knew nothing about it. And
it was right next to the list of the Friday movies.
Right next to Freaky Friday. And I'm a big Jamie Lee Curtis fan, so I was excited about that. But no, I watched probably that first episode, and I remember just laughing at it because, like, the mannequins walking around in rows, it was just so ridiculous to me. But I stuck with it, and, you know, I always tell people, you know, after you finish that first season, that's when it really starts to get good. I mean, Christopher Eccleston was all right, but, I mean, it was a little ridiculous for that first season. But, yeah, I mean, I stuck with it. I'm super glad I did. It's my favorite show, hands down.
Excellent. Very well. Happy to have you on, and hopefully we learn a little bit from each other about what our doctor tendencies are. Let's get right into it. It's season 6 midway. We just had our
6.5.
6.5. Just had our second episode of this half called Night Terrors. Writer was Mark Gatiss, director Richard Clark. What did you guys think of Night Terrors? First thoughts. Throw it out there.
It was okay. I didn't think it was great. I didn't think it was terrible. I thought it was a nice standalone episode. Mm-hmm. Kind of deviated away from the overall arc a little bit. Mm-hmm. No River Song, no Silence, none of that. It was
which is kind of funny because didn't they say that River Song was going to be... Didn't we hear rumors that River Song was going to be in this episode?
Yeah, but I guess that was never confirmed. Maybe it was just hearsay. Maybe it was just internet scuttlebutt. I don't know. But
IMDb shows her
making that up.
Yeah, IMDb shows are not on again until the 13th, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which is basically that last episode, right?
The always reliable IMDb.
Yeah.
But I thought it was okay. It did. For me personally, I'm a big fan of this whole overall arc and everything they've been setting up and everything they've been executing. So I thought that this was maybe the show catching its breath a little bit. That's just my interpretation. It felt, I guess, you can describe it as a little more classic Who, I guess. I don't want to say Monster of the Week, but definitely standalone. But it doesn't make it bad. You know, it was solid. There were some great parts to it, which I'm sure we'll get to. But for me personally, I thought it was okay. I don't think it'll go down as a great episode. I don't even know if it'll be really remembered, especially with everything else we've seen this season. But you know, for Doctor Who, I thought it was still stellar. It's hard not to be stellar on Doctor Who. So,
how about you, Michael? What did you think?
Yeah, I don't know. I wasn't really feeling it, and I think kind of my problem with it was just I didn't feel like this was really the right time for a standalone episode. I feel like, you know, we just waited, 3 months for the show to come back on and left it on such a cliffhanger. And I know they resolved a lot of that with Let's Kill Hitler, but I think I was kind of expecting something that tied a little bit more into the central arc. I don't know, maybe that's why I didn't like it as much, because I was just a little bit disappointed. But I mean, it wasn't a bad episode. There was definitely some parts that I liked about it. But, you know, for the most part, I just wasn't really feeling it.
You know, something that that you mentioned, Sean, was really interesting. You said it was kind of like classic Doctor Who, and you brought up the whole Monster of the Week thing. I initially kind of had the same thoughts as the both of you, which was it was a fine episode. It was kind of nice as a way to catch your breath a little bit. But I didn't really think too much about it until speaking to one of my friends at work who grew up watching Doctor Who in the UK, one of my British coworkers, and he mentioned that he absolutely loved it because it was classic Doctor Who. It was back to like Doctor Who from the 60s and 70s. Yeah. That did have a little bit of a horror base to it, where it was meant to kind of give you the heebie-jeebies, so to speak. And he even mentioned how you know, growing up watching Doctor Who, he was hiding behind the couch whimpering. And this episode brought a little bit of that back, to the point where he was kind of freaked out a few times. So, you know, that I don't want to necessarily say it changed my perspective of the show, but I understand now more than ever why how that show kind of fits into just the overall Doctor Who mythology, I guess you could say. I was kind of in the same feeling as you guys. I don't think it was one of the best episodes. I enjoyed it. I actually thought it was told very well. The whole idea of the Doctor making a quote-unquote house call, which he said he hadn't done in a while, was kind of interesting, kind of novel. But, you know, again, he's helping people, which we haven't seen him do outside of Amy and Rory recently. So I thought it was an overall interesting episode, something that's fine as a standalone show. What about you, Steven? What did you think?
Meh. It was just kind of meh to me. I guess I didn't. I kind of agree with the first you guys first the first two guys, Sean and Mike. It was definitely a Monster of the Week episode. Like, there's no getting around that. As for like it to hearkening back to Classic Who, most of my Classic Who experience is with the John Pertwee / Tom Baker era, which I understand Tom Baker probably had a lot, and he was probably a lot more Monster of the Week and stuff like that too. But most, like, again, what I'm trying to get at is my experience with old classic Doctor Who wasn't really the heebie-jeebies horror kind of thing. It was more, especially the John Pertwee stuff, was very much about broad ideas and big crazy science gone wrong and stuff like that, like the Green Death, that sort of thing. One thing that felt really odd to me about the episode is it actually kind of felt like this sort of hodgepodge of ideas that from previous episodes of Doctor Who, to the point where it almost felt to me like it was kind of the episode was maybe just kind of thrown together at the last minute for the sake of maybe some studio pressure, maybe, you know, or whatever you call BBC, I don't know, studio production house or something, to make a bottle episode that didn't focus on the main story, because like it takes a lot of concepts from episodes earlier on in the revised series, like the concept of being touched and being turned into this other thing, which is pretty much straight out of the first Stephen Moffat story. Yeah. I forget what it's called. And then there's the little kid imagining things into existence, which is taken straight out of Fear Her from season 2, which is, for the record, the worst episode of Doctor Who ever made.
So. okay.
Or at least I've never seen a worse one than Fear Her. And I just kind of, it was definitely better told than a bottle episode normally would be to me in a show like this. But I didn't really feel strongly about it one way or the other. It just felt kind of bland and gray, you know? And, yeah, I guess, I was actually kind of disappointed with that it wasn't as cool as I thought it was. Cause in the trailers, the, doll things or whatever they were, I never really fully understood what they were supposed to be in the episode. I thought they looked really cool and I thought that was going to be a pretty interesting storyline. And I never really actually figured out what they were supposed to be or represent or whatever, but oh well. Yeah, that's pretty much sums up my experience with Night Terrors.
It's interesting because supposedly this episode was originally supposed to air in the first part of the season, and it got bumped back to this slot for a variety of reasons. I don't know if it was pacing. I know budget has something to do with it because I know the BBC doesn't give Doctor Who a terribly large budget, and obviously they do spend that on episodes like Pandorica opening or Good Man Goes to War, stuff like that. So I'm sure that there were reasons for that as well, and that's why this has been so contained. And, you know, if it was originally supposed to be in the first part of the season, that may have been, you know, some of the reasons why, you know, Amy and Rory were kind of, I don't want to say second tier, but there wasn't really any development there. They were just kind of there, and then they were kind of in trouble, and then they kind of weren't. And it's just such a contrast to everything else that's been going on. But if they did move it for that reason and other reasons, then it makes a little more sense to me. But I agree with everybody else. I thought it was kind of, I think it's hard. I think it's really hard when you go out of your way to do such a season like this, to do so much and to go on such a grand scheme and an overall story, to go back to this. I mean, I guess the pirate episode was the last one that was really like this.
Yeah.
And I mean, arguably then, the Doctor's wife. But
the Doctor's wife was kind of standalone-ish.
Yeah.
But that was a much better episode.
But it was so good that it was forgivable, you know?
I don't necessarily think that it's a bad thing to have bottle episodes. It's just that
I don't either. Yeah.
There's really good bottle episodes. I don't think we don't see as many of them, so we're kind of taken off guard. Because, I mean, when you compare Stephen Moffat to Russell T. Davies, I mean, Russell T. Davies, a majority were bottle episodes.
And now, up until season 5 was bottle episodes with a little bit at the end.
Right. We only get like one or two here every so often, and it's, you know, it kind of takes me off guard. But yeah, I mean, I didn't realize that they were actually supposed to air Night Terrors at a different time. But that's one of the feelings I just couldn't shake as I was watching it. It was like, this could be literally placed anywhere in the season because it doesn't reference anything. Not even at the very tail end, they kind of allude to it, but for the most part, it has nothing to do with the rest of the series.
It literally could have happened right after the series premiere, and it wouldn't have felt different to me at all.
Right.
Exactly.
Season premiere, whatever.
Yeah. But in terms of strengths of the episode, I don't know, Dolly, if you want to talk about individual stuff at this point.
Yeah, we can.
Pros and cons, maybe.
Sure.
Matt Smith, again, I thought knocked it out of the park.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's just a given now. I know we say it every week, but it's just so – he's just so good. He's just so good.
What's really interesting is – and I had the same conversation with my British friend at work. To me, Matt Smith has now become maybe my favorite Doctor of these last three. He may have eclipsed David Tennant just because he's become you're exactly right. He's become so good at that role. It's like he has – himself become this character, and he plays it to the nth degree,
and I could see that too. You know, you get no argument for me on that. I don't know if he's eclipsed David Tennant in my eyes just because I'm such a fan, and that's how I got started. You know, that's how I got started. Everybody has their doctor, but
everybody's first doctor. Yep.
But yeah, I mean, his performance, you know, sitting there with what was his name, George was the kid,
yes,
you know, trying to reassure him while trying to work out what was going on, showing him what the sonic screwdriver did, activating all his toys, or the scene with his dad when he's trying to make tea and his dad's trying to stop him and get him out of the house. Like, it's just one thing after another with Matt Smith, and it's just like constantly brilliant, and it's just such a joy to watch at this point.
What about the the monsters, I guess. What do you guys feel about them?
That was a weak point of the episode to me, for sure. I mean, it was kind of so cliche, right? You got the big haunted house, and you've got the little girl, and I mean, granted, they were puppets, but that's been done too, right? And you know, they just didn't really seem all that menacing to me. I mean, in the end, they're just poking at him with scissors, and that's all you got to do to keep these guys at bay. And you know, they kind of pretended like it was difficult, but it wasn't.
So what were they? I mean, were they there before he started trapping people in the cupboard? That's where I'm a little confused, because obviously they turn people, you know, almost like a zombie kind of way or a Borg kind of way for Star Trek fans. But
I watched it. I watched it again today, and just because I didn't quite get it, and it looked like everything that was in there was George just manifesting it.
Right.
So everything was just him creating it out of his mind.
So then I guess it just kind of grew from there.
I mean, this isn't exactly the first time that that Doctor Who has thrown in a subset of monsters for no apparent reason. I mean, it's for the kids, isn't it? I mean, like, at the end of the day, Doctor Who is technically supposed to be billed still as partially a kids' show.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Amazing to me. And they always kind of throw in a subset of monster for the kids. And the best episodes are the ones where they tie those little kid monsters into the main threat too, or the episodes that have a main threat. Like I think the best example is the Family of Blood two-part episode in season 3 with the Scarecrow army. I thought the Scarecrows were definitely the monsters for the kids, but then you had the Family of Blood, which was like this psychopathic alien group of sociopaths that just straight up murdering people left and right. And then at the very tail end of the story, they tie it back into the Scarecrow thing back into things by the Doctor turning one of the guys into a living Scarecrow trapped in time forever. Creepy ending there. So, but there was no real main threat to this one. It was very much like Fear Her, where to me, which was the villains, kind of felt toothless. It kind of felt like there wasn't anything to be afraid of or to really push the story forward. It felt like they were just kind of floating along. And Matt Smith, Arthur Darvill, Karen Gillan, they're all fantastic, as we've all said many times before. But I just didn't feel like they had much to do in this episode. Like any of them, even Matt Smith, to an extent. Like, I don't know what I watched. The more I think about it, the more I realize I just don't like this episode.
we're talking ourselves into the void of negativity. Really,
the God, more we Dolly, kind of break it down. Positive,
quick.
Yeah. Amy's hot.
Yes, she is.
I agree.
Have I ever gone on the show on record and said that redheads are my kryptonite? Because that's totally a thing. I love redheads so much. I just want that out there.
There you go.
If the Doctor was a ginger.
Oh, I know, right?
Well, let's move on. Unless there's anything else you guys want to mention about,
I think that was the most half-hearted episode discussion we've ever had.
It is. I think it's because we've been doing so much catch-up on previous shows, but this episode wasn't pivotal in any way. So,
and there's just not a lot to talk about. Yeah, it's like Doctor shows up, has a little like zany, you know, interactions with these residents trying to find the kid, and then he finds the kid, and then the kid's a monster, but is he a monster? We don't know. And then Amy and Rory are gone, but then they're in trouble, but then they're not, and then the Doctor saves the day. Yay! Mm-hmm. There's just not a lot to break down, you know?
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
That's kind of an accurate description of most episodes.
I was about to say, this one wasn't presented with any of the Doctor Who flair that we've come to expect.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. Right. And there's just not a lot to rave over, but there's also not a lot to break down. It's just kind of was there.
It was a very rote episode. Like, it was very by the numbers.
He did have that one excellent moment when he's pointing the sonic screwdriver at the cupboard and trying to reassure George, and you keep hearing the screwdriver make higher and higher pitched noises, and then he gets really scared all of a sudden.
That was good. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh,
I thought that part was excellent, but other than that,
That's the only thing I can talk about in this episode. It's always cool to see Matt Smith scared.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah,
he's the first Doctor I can ever think of that has actually physically been on screen in a really physical sense, terrified, with the exception of maybe David Tennant at the very end of David Tennant's run with the when he found out the Time Lords were returning and whatnot, then when he grabs the gun and whatnot.
But, yeah.
Let's just move on. Seriously.
Well, let's move on. We actually need we have to catch up a little bit on Torchwood. I don't know who has who's caught up. I know I have.
I'm caught up.
You're caught up as well. Okay. And I think you are, Sean, as well.
Everything almost up until the most recent episode.
Okay.
Well, I'm in the same boat. I'm caught up to episode 8. I haven't seen 9.
I did a little marathon last night. I'm so tired. I'm all Torchwooded out.
Well,
I was like, I have to catch up for the podcast.
I almost watched episode 9 today, but I just couldn't bring myself to do it. I don't know why.
Sure, sure. There's only one episode left, so maybe we'll talk up to episode 8, and then we'll...
We can just save Torchwood talk till like the finale, too, because it's not like Torchwood gets much mention on this episode either.
The finale is this Friday.
Yeah. So. I'm saying
we could do a kind of a whole recap.
Yeah, because, yeah, I mean... Sounds good. Because I would like to, I mean, if we had all seen the latest episode, we could talk about how excited we were for the next episode, for the finale, but we haven't all seen it.
That's
I should watch it, I know, but oh well.
Okay, well, let's do that then. We'll wait till our next Lonely TARDIS to talk about Torchwood, and then by then we'll have seen the latest.
We'll have seen the whole thing, and we can do a Torchwood-centric episode, if depending on how big the next episode of Doctor Who is.
Yeah, the girl who waited, which I'm hearing is supposed to be pretty good. So
yeah, I like the concept and I like how it looks, and I like two Amys.
you would. Well, one of the big. Sorry.
I feel like every week that we break the hearts of like half a dozen Torchwood fans.
They're
so excited, and then it's just like, nope, sorry, next week, one more week.
It's like
a bait and switch. It's like you've got to keep coming back.
Breaking the hearts of half a dozen Torchwood fans is way worse when you consider that that is the entirety of the Torchwood fan base
in the U.S. Yeah.
We'll get into
Torchwood.
That.
Don't get me wrong, Torchwood.
No,
fans.
Me too. Yeah, me too.
We'll get into that next week. This week, let's focus on Doctor Who. And the main reason that I wanted I know Michael on, because Michael is. Do you want Mike or Michael? What would you prefer?
I usually go by Mike, but whatever.
Sounds good, Michael. So we wanted you. No, I'll call you Mike.
Michael Scott.
You are a wealth of Doctor Who knowledge. And on the last episode, I gave everybody an assignment to pick their maybe 3 to 5 Doctor Who episodes for kind of catching up on the whole Doctor Who phenomenon, and only all the way back to 2005, so you don't have to go back to William Hartnell. We did have somebody post in the comments of our last episode a phenomenal list that went all the way back to Hartnell and Baker and Davison, and so it was an awesome list by I think Ilrad is his name, Yeah, so I figured let us chat about Doctor Who and what we think are kind of the most important episodes to catch up on this phenomenon. So who wants to go first? I mean, I figure we'll just kind of go around the table. We'll talk a little bit about what episodes we think are important, and kind of just have a little bit of roundtable. You know, I'll go ahead and start since I was the first to throw my list in the agenda, which you don't have to do. I think, and this is a big turnoff for a lot of people, this episode, but Rose, the very first episode of this kind of new, the new regeneration, I guess, of Doctor Who, with Christopher Eccleston, and the reason I say it is because there's this. It's not so much that it's about Doctor Who, because obviously it is, but it's the new concept, the new direction that Russell T. Davies took the show, which is not just about the Doctor's character, but about all these people, how the Doctor affects all these people, what's happening in their lives. And at the same time, it kind of introduced this idea of people knowing who this Doctor is, or they've been kind of watching this Doctor over the decades or centuries, and they've seen photos of him. I think there's one scene in that episode where they show photos of him at like the Kennedy assassination and kind of great events across modern history. So I thought that was kind of a really interesting episode and a great way to me set up what the Doctor is, which is this kind of weird time traveling character. I don't know. What do you guys think? How do you guys feel about that first episode, Rose?
I like it. I almost put that on my list, actually, because I kind of feel like, even though, like I said earlier, you know, I watched it not knowing what Doctor Who was, and I just thought it was completely ridiculous. I think that it really kind of sets the tone for what Doctor Who is, because, I mean, if you go into Doctor Who thinking that it's anything but ridiculous, kind of got the wrong expectation. But, I mean, it sets the tone for who the Doctor is. The nice thing about the reboot and starting with Rose is that you don't have to have seen the 40-plus years or whatever that they had before that. You can really kind of get into it and, understand what's going on by the end of that first episode. Mm-hmm. In fact, the first time I watched it, I thought that the show started with Rose. I didn't realize that it had been such a long-running thing.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm the same. I thought about it. I was looking over season one episodes. I like it. I like it because it is a fresh start. But I came in for, I think, season three, and then I went back and watched those. So I don't know. I get it. I get why you would add it. I personally wouldn't, just because we only have a couple of slots, and I think there's better ones. Even in season one, I think there are better episodes than Rose. For people who are coming in off, if they just can see a couple, then I would pick other ones. But I think it's an absolute, it makes total sense. And I think if you're going to start and then watch chronologically and you're committed to the show, then absolutely start with Rose. But I don't know if you're just jumping around to try to get a feel for it. I don't know if I would necessarily start there.
Sure.
Okay. So then from there, I moved on to a couple of the more recent ones, into the David Tennant era and beyond. And for me, these all kind of go together in terms of setting up what Matt Smith is today. I moved a couple of them into the runners-up initially and moved them back and forth, kind of fought over it. But Silence in the Library, I thought was... to me, it was a really important episode in that it set up... who River Song is, right? It was the first meeting and kind of this really weird, the whole timey-wimey thing that's beyond the Doctor's scope. I mean, there's stuff that's happening now to the Doctor in meeting River Song that he had never, he'd never met her yet. She already knows so much about him, and she's in his future, whereas he's normally, really in control of the flow of time. Now, all of a sudden, things are becoming broken. And the monsters. I think it was the Vashnarada. Were that episode? Was that the name of the?
Yeah, and they
were
shadows.
They were just such excellent, antagonists that I thought the whole thing was done really well. So I really kind of listed that as one of the, great episodes to watch.
Sure.
And, feel free to chime in while I'm going through these guys in case you guys think I'm an idiot for picking one over the other, but which I'm sure will come up with.
I'm looking at your list right now, and it looks great to me so far.
And it's funny because I've noticed a few of us have a lot of these same ones. And you know what? Let's move on to one of the ones that all of us seem to have, or a lot of us seem to have, which is The Waters of Mars.
Yeah.
Mike and Sean, both you guys have that listed. Sean, you have it in your quote-unquote runners-up. Mike, you have it in kind of your main one. And probably for the same reason that all three of us are going to be interested in it. But Mike, go ahead. Why don't you let us know about The Waters of Mars since you're kind of in that zone first.
I really like the Waters of Mars just because of kind of how it leads up, how it leads into the end of time. And it really, like, towards the end of David Tennant's run, it really kind of embodies the way, what he's starting to become. I think they call him, the Time Lord Victorious. I really picked it mainly for that end scene, and I don't know how we feel about spoilers at this point, being such an old episode.
No, you can go ahead.
Okay.
No, we're good.
Really just for his, huge speech when he's trying to decide whether or not to save the crew of that of that Mars space station, and he's like, it's taken me all this time to realize it, but the laws of time are mine, you know, being the last Time Lord, and it's really just kind of...
Hold on one sec, not to interrupt, but I'm going to anyway. I just want to say that it's criminal that you did not mention that the name of the Mars base was Bowie Base 1.
Oh yeah.
Which is the best name for any space station in history.
Yeah, it was just so, like, I don't know, it just, I got chills listening to that speech. It's one of my all-time favorite Doctor speeches, which is, you know, the speeches are kind of what I think is the best part of the show, but I don't know, I just feel like it's must-see.
Hmm.
It's, you know, to me, what was really interesting about the Waters of Mars, well, I mean, the antagonists are really well done, but the fact that the Doctor starts to realize that, you know, and I noted this in Fires of Pompeii, which I listed as well, the Doctor decides that, you know, again, like you mentioned, he's Time Lord Victorious. At the same time, he starts to break a lot of the rules that he, you know, lived by over time as a Time Lord. He set forth this, you know, you got to make sure that it doesn't affect the flow of time before or after this moment. And, you know, he tended to know what was going to happen next, and that's why he was doing a lot of these actions. Whereas in Waters of Mars, he said, you know, screw it, I'm going to save these people, even though they're meant to die, even though he knows they're meant to die, he's still going to try to save one. And then at the end of the episode, they get pissed at him. The captain gets upset with him saving her because obviously he knew that she was meant to pass away, and now all of a sudden all these things that were supposed to happen are not going to happen or are going to happen a different way. So I thought it was that, for that idea, was a really great episode. And again, like you said, it really leads in well to kind of his, I guess you could almost call it like his downfall from being this victorious guy who's always saving the universe to someone who's kind of screwing up the universe.
Right.
So, I thought that was really well done. And again, I mean, to me, Fires of Pompeii kind of fits in that area as well. And that's one of the first few times the Doctor, at least in this modern era, breaks his you know, Time Lord rules and actually rescues a family from Pompeii with, you know, Donna convinces him to do so, Donna Noble. And I thought that episode was really well done just for that fact that, you know, he changed something. In that instance, it didn't really affect... I don't remember it affecting much beyond him rescuing this family, since they still kind of lived their own life without really, you know, going too far out from that. But, you know, I think in tandem with the Waters of Mars, I thought it was just kind of a really good two-part kind of telling of the same story.
Right.
Sure. For me, Waters of Mars is great for all the reasons you guys listed, especially seeing this kind of ascension and ultimate peak for Tennant's Time Lord before he kind of realizes that he's gone too far. But he's also running. I mean, you know, he will knock four times, had been established at that point, and he knows what's coming. But the notion of a Time Lord victorious was so fascinating and so unlike anything we had ever really seen. It's such like a a glimpse into what he could become. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, a lot of people referenced at the time, you know, it could have been a glimpse, because I know there's something in the older series where I forget the character's name, but it's actually a future version of the Doctor. Like, it's all of his bad side that has come out. Stranger. And like after his final incarnation.
I think it's called Stranger.
I wish I could remember his name. It might be. I'm literally blanking on it. But I love the allusion to stuff like that.
Yeah.
And how one, you know, the last of a species could be so, you know, that had all that power and was never allowed to use it, but now all of a sudden the rules are gone. So
yep.
It's great. It's really great. I don't know if I would necessarily list it as a must-see episode for somebody who's coming in fresh to Doctor Who, just because there's so much behind it and there's so much that it leads into. I don't necessarily think I would introduce it, at least not in my top five. But again, I'm looking at it as more of a, you know, you've never seen the show, you know, you kind of want to get a feel for it. I don't know if I would necessarily show because of everything that's happened to the 10th Doctor, how he kind of reaches that peak and then all that darkness that's already surrounding him and all the death. Like, because there's a lot you need to know going into that, especially even from the specials alone, let alone everything that happened at the end of season 5 with or 4 with Donna and all that other stuff. So, but in terms of performances, in terms of story, and in terms of stuff that if you've been following the show, then absolutely. I mean, Waters of Mars instantly skyrockets up to like the top 5, but I don't know if I would do it as like, you know, getting into the show.
Sure, sure. So what I'm going to, just to let you guys know what I'm doing in the show notes here, is I'm color coding the episodes that we're listing with green, red, and yellow to determine if we all kind of felt that they fit in with this idea of the best and kind of the quintessential episode. So basically for me, Rose and Silence of the Library fit into that quintessential episode. Maybe Fires of Pompeii and Waters of Mars are maybes, but maybe more towards maybe not. So they're kind of second tier, I guess, to the first two that I listed. And those are the ones I had. My runner-up was Blink, only because I thought it was just an awesome, it was a fun episode, and it went to, you know, it went to the Doctor kind of doing what he does best, which is his knowledge of time. And for those that don't know, it was the episode with, I think it was that the first appearance of the angels.
Yeah, it sure was.
Just a fantastic introduction to these characters that if you look away, you know, they're going to turn you into stone. You're going to be dead essentially. But the fact that he communicated with this girl through DVDs and how she pieces it together in modern times and how he puts together in the past, it's just, it's fantastic. I thought it was really well done. But at that same time, I think it's one of those standalone episodes that don't necessarily fit into the overall quintessential, but are fun episodes as to what Doctor Who could be. So those are mine, my three or four there. Let's move on to Mike. I think you're actually next on the list here.
Dally, actually, I might have to head out here
in
a bit. I'm supposed to be hanging out with a friend here tonight that I haven't seen in a long time.
All right. Well, then if you want to go ahead, go right ahead. We'll,
do you mind, Mike?
No, go for it. I'm here all night.
All night.
Okay. So this list was like was our top three episodes?
Yes.
Okay.
I thought it was three to five.
Three to five. Really, okay. Whatever you think it gets the point across.
I could put 100 on here, but the first one I want to start off with is probably an episode that a lot of people probably don't think of when they think of quintessential Doctor Who, but Doomsday, that whole the season 2 finale episode.
Okay.
Now, I think, like, now, bear with me, because that's Doomsday isn't by any stretch my favorite episode of Doctor Who. I don't like it that much. The Daleks versus the Cybermen was pretty cool, I guess. But what it did have was it was the final episode proper with Rose as a proper companion. Mm-hmm. And for anybody who's new to this show, if you want to see Doctor Who at its absolute most heartbreaking, go watch the episode Doomsday. I don't know how much of an emotional impact it might have. It'll certainly be blunted if you're not familiar with the series from the beginning one up, but I think that last three to five minutes of the episode where the Doctor blows up a sun to talk to Rose one final time to power the thing to talk to
Rose. Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the moment. That's the cincher of why that episode matters. And then just the absolute most heartbreaking thing I have that up until that point I had ever seen on TV. And it was definitely what cinched Doctor Who as probably my favorite show of that time, back in that time, all those years ago.
You know what's interesting is that I think if you couple that with Rose, that initial episode, and then you almost need an episode in between that features Rose or
Father's Day, maybe.
Yeah, would maybe Father's Day, because then that makes an awesome story arc for those first few seasons of Doctor Who.
Exactly.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't want to spoil it because this is supposed to be for new people of this people new to the show and whatnot. But that last scene in that episode, I was just lost my shit. I couldn't handle it. That still gets me every time I see that. Again, I'm trying to avoid talking about it too much because it's supposed to be for new people. But anyway, that's a great episode. Cool. Just for, if only just for that final moment, and it kind of does tie in a bunch of enemies of the of famous enemies of the Doctor that you would that I think it's a good way of it. It does a, it goes a ways towards introducing you to the two of the biggest players in the Doctor Who villain rogues gallery. You know, by bringing in the Cybermen and the Daleks. The next one on my list is The Family of Blood, which I mentioned earlier. Which also, I mean, it's a bottle episode, but the reason I think it's great is it captures so much of Doctor Who in it. I think it just, it captures, like, the fear that, personally, I think the Family of Blood is one of the scariest villains on that has ever been on Doctor Who, especially of the new series. Just the sociopathic alien force that burns out like mayflies, and the Doctor, it starts with the Doctor hiding from them, it takes that scariness, and then you multiply that by the fact that the Doctor actually takes himself out of being the Doctor. He gives himself amnesia, makes himself human, makes himself vulnerable. So you, on top of everything, you get to see a side of the Doctor that up until that point you had never seen before. The Doctor stripped of all his Time Lord lordliness.
Time Lord lordliness.
Time lordliness. And just down to his basic bare bones, just his personality with none of his capability. And it was, you know, up until that point, you'd never seen the Doctor in that light before, that, like, so vulnerable, so dependent on other people. And again, just like Doomsday, absolutely heartbreaking ending. Mm-hmm. It's so sad. I probably didn't lose my shit as much in that one as I did in Doomsday, but again, it's very sad. It's scary. It's sad. It's got action. You get to see the more human side of the Doctor. He's never been more likable than in that episode, just because you get to see him stripped of all of his hottie toddy, you know, technology and craziness. And at the same time, at the very end, still comes in with his Doctor Who maneuver and blows up the Armada, or, you know, saves the world, that sort of thing.
Right. Well, and they revisit that episode too at the end of The End of Time, when he's going back and, like, seeing all the people that he affected before he regenerates into Matt Smith.
Yeah.
And that was like super heartbreaking too, on top of that.
Yeah. Great story, I think. And on top of everything, it's kind of it's a bottle story, so that new people coming in and watch it don't really need to know too much about Doctor Who to go in there and understand what's going on, because it just comes in and tells its story. An example of a great bottle episode on Doctor Who, which Night Terrors was not. So, I was going to say Blink, but since you already mentioned, since I'm sure everybody's going to mention Blink, somebody's going to mention Blink, and you already did mention Blink to a little bit of an extent, darling. Yeah. I'm going to go with my second choice for that slot, which was Midnight, which is another bottle episode. But I choose Midnight because I feel like in Midnight you really get it really helps to give you a sense of the Doctor's. Because the Doctor, it's the only episode I can think of where the Doctor is completely without a companion for like 99% of the episode. And so you see how the Doctor deals with other people and deals with things on his own. And you see a lot of different people questioning the Doctor that normally wouldn't be, because they would be his companions and they would trust him and know him and whatnot. So you see how he deals with situations by himself. You begin to understand what part of why he brings these companions with him. More than any other episode, you get to see the Doctor completely stripped of any help. He's just the Doctor,
right?
Being the Doctor,
and they also don't trust him. Nobody trusts him on that thing.
Exactly,
on the shuttle bus.
Mm-hmm. And and another important thing about it is it teaches you what he thinks of everyone else, like how that he's a little bit arrogant. That he does think he's a little bit better than everybody else, even if he doesn't realize that he's a little bit better than everyone else. There's a great moment in there where he's basically like, he says, "You should all listen to me." And somebody actually calls him out on it for like the first time ever and says, "Why should we listen to you?" And he says, "Well, basically because I'm me." And, And then they're like, what difference does that make? And he's like, well, you know, he kind of realizes there at a moment that he they should all listen to him because he's better than them. But at the same time, he spends the entire series talking about how amazing the human race is and how much he loves them and everything. But then at the same time, you see them turn against him. And also a very scary episode, probably up until that point, for my money, was the scariest episode of Doctor Who I had ever seen, because you do see the Doctor, again, at a much more vulnerable pace. You get to see the Doctor almost lose, and in fact, like, he would have lost had it not been for a person that he had just barely met and knew nothing about saving him in the end.
And it is really funny. Well, I don't say funny, but it again, it's another one of those heartbreaking things where, you know, the whole scene with the hostess, she dies, and then he realizes that, you know, nobody knew her name.
Oh yeah,
and that
becomes such an important thing to even in Matt Smith's character in The Vampires of Venice. That becomes such an important thing that you always have to remember the names of the people that died because of what you did to him. So I think that was I love that episode. I love Midnight. It's scary. It's very mature, especially for a Russell T. Davies episode. So many Russell T. Davies episodes have giant talking rhinos and spider people and whatnot. And it's just like, he gets so silly some of the times. And that is such a stark and dark episode for Doctor Who. Almost, pretty kind of up there with the episode Dalek from season one, which it's just very dark and bleak. And there's not a lot of redemption for anybody involved. And then not a lot of resolution for anybody involved either. And then I just want to mention for my runner-up, I'm just going to stick with three because I think three is a good round number for this. But my runner-up is Love and Monsters. Does anybody remember that?
Oh, yeah, that was the one where they were – the Doctor wasn't even in the episode.
He was at
towards
the
very end.
At the very end and the very, very beginning in a flashback.
Yes, yeah.
And Love and Monsters, I didn't throw it in because I don't think it really holds up quite as well as maybe it did when
you
I
you know what that one that, again that one kind of reminds me of Blink in that again
it's an episode of Doctor Who without the Doctor in it,
exactly.
Really.
And where he still somehow gets people to save the planet or to save a situation.
Right.
And that episode's great because it's I'm trying to add some variety into this list too. It's very funny. it's hilarious to an extent, and but at the same time, better than any other episode I've ever seen of Doctor Who, captures that bittersweet that so many of the greatest episodes have, where it's like, great, we saved the universe, but look at all that we've lost, and look at the bright side, but look at how terrible and heartbreaking all of this is. But that very bittersweet line that Doctor Who walks, and the end of Love and Monsters to this day just sticks with me as just being such a bold episode. In that, again, I don't want to spoil too much, but it's just so sad, but at the same time, there's that hope there too at the end, just enough hope where you don't want to kill yourself for having watched the episode.
I'll tell you why that episode's good. It's that they have like three Electric Light Orchestra songs in that episode.
That is true. And make notice of the fact that they're listening to Electric Light Orchestra, ELO. Also has some of the raunchiest and most adult humor I've ever heard of on Doctor Who. Which, if you go back and look at that episode, you might notice there is an oral sex joke at the very end of the episode.
Oh, yeah.
I always felt bad for that actress. It's the actress who played Moaning Myrtle in Harry Potter, and I'm sure she's been Moaning Myrtle. I'm sure she's a fantastic actress, but I'm just so scared for her that she's just going to be forever remembered as that chick who made like a dick sucking joke at the end of an episode of Doctor Who. But yeah, it's a funny bittersweet episode, very bleak but very hopeful at the same time. It's hard to describe. Doctor Who walks that tightrope of that bittersweet ending so well with so many of the episodes, which I don't think they've really done recently in the episodes. It's with David Tennant going out, it was very just bleak, not bittersweet at all. And then with recently, it hasn't really been – there hasn't really been much bleakness to it. Everything kind of gets resolved in the end a little bit better than most episodes. I mean, I remember there being them making a big deal in the first season that there was an episode where nobody dies. And the Doctor was like freaking out because nobody died. The Doctor dances. The Doctor dances, yeah.
Yeah.
And then in this – but in this season – or in these latest seasons – they don't seem to make that much of a big deal out of it anymore because it seems like people survive the episodes all the time now. Like just in this latest episode, nobody dies, you know, and I feel like they've kind of lost that bittersweetness, and I would love to see kind of a return to that. But I'm sure they will when they have to get a new companion, because as we all know, nobody that travels with the Doctor ever ends up in a good situation. every time something happened, every time everybody he goes with, something terrible happens to them.
I don't know, because Mickey is dating Martha now, or no, they're married.
Married, yeah.
And that's a pretty good situation. I don't know what you guys think, but
I hate Freema Agyeman, so.
What?
Oh.
No, I mean, that's fine. I guess.
Thank you.
But, like, he's not. He was never really a full companion, though. At the same time, you know, he was like
he got the short end of the stick. He was so that's why one of the reasons I never could get behind Rose. Like everybody fell in love with Rose, and the way she treated Mickey, just I thought it was terrible. She was a huge bitch.
She totally was.
She was terrible, and everybody loved her. And I just
she was that terrible girl that like you liked her, but she was like Amy. If Amy had never figured out that Rory was in love with her, or if when she did figure out that Rory was in love with her, had said "fuck you" instead of hurting him.
Pretty much, and that's what everybody was afraid of when Amy started getting all kissy kissy with the Doctor last season.
Trying to seduce the Doctor, which still is a standout moment from last season to me. I love that. That whole scene makes me laugh. Anyway, I'm going to head out, gents. I will talk to you guys later. Sorry, I had this one short.
Thanks for hopping on.
No problem. I will catch up on my Torchwood for next episode, and I will be there for the full time next time.
You'll listen to this episode as well.
Well, yeah, the rest of course. Of this,
obviously. All right,
I'll have to catch up.
There you go.
I mean, obviously this won't be a bottle episode.
Yeah, there you go.
I get it. Ha 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 ha.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
See bye.
All
bye.
Right, let's bye, go boy. On to let's go on to Mike. Mike, you had a few here as well.
Oh, I got a few. But yeah, I think my first one on the list was the Christmas Invasion, because I kind of think it really sets the tone for who David Tennant's Doctor is. And actually, I just now noticed I don't have any Matt Smith in my list at all. I mean, there's some good stuff, but I mean, I think that just stems back to David Tennant being my Doctor. Mm-hmm. But the Christmas Invasion, it really like kind of sets the tone for who David Tennant is. You know, he's somebody who can like who can recognize intelligence wherever he sees it, even when it's the bad guy. Like that scene when he's like when he gets onto the Sigarak ship and he's like he's like, how are you controlling these people? And then he finds out, he's like, oh, blood control. Oh, I haven't seen blood control in years. Like, you know, and it's they're evil. I mean, but he's like, wow, that's brilliant. Like, I mean, I think there's an episode where, like what's it called? The one where he meets Satan the Satan pit. And he mentions he describes Satan as being brilliant. Like, and I mean, you know what he means. He's not, you know, endorsing them at all, but he recognizes intelligence, and he's like, you know, he says the master, he's like, you know, when he tells the master that they should travel together, he's like, oh, we'd be magnificent. And I think it really sets the tone for that. And I think, I think that was pretty much the only reason I selected that one. Mm-hmm. I had the girl in the fireplace.
Oh, one of my favorite episodes. Oh,
It's one of the best for sure. Just because of the way some of my favorite Doctor Who episodes are the ones where they just use time. They just have blatant disregard for time. Mm-hmm. You know, they're
and
just
this is one of them.
Mm-hmm. This was one of them for sure. I think it was a little bit more tame than, say, like, what was it? Losing my train of thought. The Big Bang, you know, he's teleporting all over the place. This is a little bit more tame than that, but just the fact that in just a couple of relative hours in the Doctor's life, he can have such a huge impact on one person. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's one of those things where, you know, for a new person coming into Doctor Who, you really have to realize that, you know, there's people that see him, you know, as a child. Like, I think the same thing happens in Love and Monsters, where, you know, the guy, the main, you know, character from that story sees him in his house as a child and then spends his whole life looking for him. But that could have been over just a period of like a week for the Doctor. And it's kind of the, you know, the tragedy of what the people that he leaves behind has to deal with. Mm-hmm. And it was just, I mean, it was brilliant. The monsters in the Girl in the Fireplace were excellent too. Those like kind of clockwork robots, you know, and it was just brilliant.
Well, and then he almost has this short love affair with Madame de Pompadour. Mm-hmm. You know, she definitely falls for him, and in like you said, in just what seems like maybe 3 hours of his life, he pretty much falls in love with this girl. You know,
right? Where he's like, I just snogged Madame de Pompadour.
Yeah,
pulls the fireplace and disappears.
Yeah, see ya, yoink.
Mm-hmm. And you get kind of a, that was kind of some good bonding time for Rose and Mickey too. Yeah. You know, because that was, I think that was like the Mickey's like first adventure with the Doctor since being introduced. Mm-hmm. You know, he got a little bit of a screen time there, which is nice. Because I always liked Mickey as a character. Yeah. You know, I think, you know, he did get the short end of the stick, but I still think I liked having him as a recurring character.
He was essentially what, you know, I should say he's, Rory has kind of taken that role to a whole new level. The boyfriend right. / husband.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, definitely. Okay. After that, of course, we talked about Silence in the Library. I have a hard time separating Silence in the Library from Forest of the Dead. So I kind of included those as one episode. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, my main reason for including that was just because it's, it really like sets the tone for River and River storyline, mm-hmm. Which, you know, seeing it the first time, I still thought it was a great episode, and I probably still would have included it even before I knew that River was going to be such a prominent figure in Doctor Who. But just like, you know, I'm just a sucker. One of the things that really got me into Doctor Who is just the big moments, right? Like the ends of the episodes when like when the Doctor makes some big speech or does something, you know, extremely brave or brilliant or heroic, and, you know, just brings everything together. And those are, you know, just my favorite parts. And I think Forest of the Dead has one of the best examples of that kind of moment, where, you know, you think everything's resolved. He leaves that sonic screwdriver on the book, and then they're walking away. Mm-hmm. And then he realizes, you know, he pieces everything together in his mind, and he saves her at the last second. And it was just like super, it was a big moment. I don't really, you know, the words are escaping me, of course, but, I live for those kind of moments with Doctor Who, and that was definitely one of them. That was it.
You had End of Time in there as well.
Yeah. Oh yeah. The End of Time. You know, that's, I'm going to sound like a broken record here, but that was kind of for the same reason. His kind of like farewell speech, you know, when he's like, you know, finally realizing what he's going to have to do for, what was Donna's grandfather's name?
Wilf.
When he's stuck in the, he's stuck in that ventilation chamber.
Yeah.
And the Doctor realizes, okay, the only way for me to get him out is to actually go in, you know, is to go into this other side and release him manually. And he understands what that's gonna, you know, they've been leading up to that whole he will knock four times thing for an entire season and a bunch of specials, and you know, he finally realizes that that's Wilfred, mm-hmm. and that he's what he's going to have to do. And he's got this, you know, this speech where, you know, he's, you finally see all these emotions that he's been building up and kind of bottling up for two seasons. I mean, I'm going to count those specials as a season, but he's just been bottling that up. And finally, he just releases it all. And it's like just kind of like a wave of sadness and anger and just everything that he's been feeling up until that point. And it's, I mean, I had to watch it like 3, 4, or 5 times, you know, just to really like soak it in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was, it, you know, his battle with drawing a blank, help me out, his arch nemesis.
The master?
The master.
The master, yeah. Just a fantastic way to culminate that whole, you know, the whole thing about him being the last Time Lord, and the master gets resurrected and so on. I think it was just kind of a really great way to cap David Tennant's, you know, his duration as a doctor. And again, it's those last few scenes are just so heartbreaking to see mm-hmm. him. I mean, Donna Noble has no idea who he is, and he can't go up and thank her. It's her wedding day or whatever it was. He can't go up and thank her because it's gonna kill her if she sees him, or if she starts to remember him. So there's the whole kind of duality of this doctor being both a savior and the ultimate. I guess you find out in one of the more recent episodes, he carries this great guilt about what he's done to these poor people. So it was his way of just kind of saying farewell to the problems that he kind of brought upon them.
Yeah, and that was a good. I mean, the master. I didn't even think about this. The master had one of those moments too. Moments of anger with the Time Lords. You know, when he's like, "You did this to me," and he finally. What's that Time Lord's name? I don't remember. I'm forgetting all sorts of names today. But you know, just that whole ending moment where he just starts blasting him with this energy from his hands, and you know, all the anger built up. It,
mm-hmm. Oh, Rassilon.
Rassilon, yeah. It's just a really emotional episode all around.
Yeah, and a really strong episode. Again, like you said, it was great. Just a great way to kind of cap David Tennant's career, It's really interesting to note that a lot of these episodes are they're kind of like the end caps. It's either the beginning of a season, like with Rose or some of the other ones, or it's the end of the season, which really caps who the Doctor is. And I think when it comes down to when we start narrowing these down at the end of our episode, it'll it might be a little bit more difficult to choose which one of these go in.
I think the nature of it is, you know, like we said before, a majority of Russell T. Davies shows were bottle episodes.
Yeah.
So you see all that stuff in the middle they're not necessarily the big moments. Sometimes they are, for sure. But for the most part, it's the beginning of the season or the end of the season where they really get their big stories.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Also where they got their big kind of arcs, their story arcs, mm-hmm. whereas in Stephen Moffat's era here, there's been this overall arc and a lot more two-part episodes, 2- and 3-part episodes. So
right.
And your runner-up was The Empty Child.
An
interesting episode because it introduced us to a longtime favorite.
Captain Jack. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was mostly just that. The Empty Child, hands down, the creepiest episode of Doctor Who. I can't think of a scarier episode than The Empty Child. And that was really the reason that I put it on there. Also, it had one of those moments we talked about, episodes where, you know, where everybody lives. Yeah. And there's a really big moment with Christopher Eccleston where he finally realizes that everybody's going to live through this. and he's like, just this once, Rose. And, you know, it was really great. But yeah, I just picked it because it was so scary.
Cool. Very good. Mm-hmm. Well, let's go on to Sean. I mean, tell us about your few episodes here. You've been quiet throughout this whole time, soaking this all in, just ready to tell us how wrong we are.
all your opinions are... No. No, I'm really just here to throw out names when you forget them. Master, Bazon, Valiard, whatever.
You're the wealth of knowledge that we needed.
Let me see. I have to look over my notes here because so many of these we share. Okay, so we talked about Silence in the Library, obviously. And like we said before, everybody loves Blink for so many obvious reasons. I mean, it's right. Just so good. I don't think it needs to
is it an essential episode to knowing what the Doctor's about?
I would argue yes, actually. Okay. I would. You know, because here's this guy, and I don't even think he shows up until, what, halfway through when he starts showing up on the videotapes?
Yeah.
And then he's decently prominent after that, but, you know, you've got all this stuff happening, you've got these creepy monsters, nobody's really sure what's going on, and all of a sudden this guy in a videotape, he sees what's happening, he knows what's happening, and he's kind of guiding this girl who's responding to him on the tape, which is just fantastic. I remember the first time I saw that, and I don't know. I loved it. I loved the fact that everybody, including, you know, I was clueless too. But he had already, you know, I don't even remember what the explanation was. I guess maybe she sent him the transcript or something back in time.
Yeah.
And it's just, that's so Doctor, you know, that's so the Doctor in terms of what he can do, in even when he's not manipulating time, he's manipulating time, you know, even when he's trapped somewhere, he's got the future helping him out. So, and I just think the performances there are good. I think the way they handle time travel and everything like that is really good, kind of maybe not an overview, but a good indication of where the show can go when the writing is really solid and when, you know, it's consistent from beginning to end. It was kind of a bottle story, I guess, but it was a really good one. And it introduced what has probably quickly become one of the most recognizable monsters in Doctor Who history. With the Weeping Angels.
Oh, one of those. They're sure. Such great monsters, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. They really are.
One of our future episodes we'll have to talk about. We'll have to focus on the Doctor Who monsters, but we'll see.
Oh, there's so many. But going back, so I think that would definitely be in my top.
Okay.
We talked about The Girl in the Fireplace, which I actually just watched again the other night. In terms of, I don't go back and watch too much of the season 1 to 4 Who recently. I do rewatch a lot of Matt Smith and I do rewatch some of the specials, but the recurring episodes I do watch over and over again, Girl in the Fireplace is definitely on there. I mean, I love it. I love everything about it. I love, you know, how quickly the relationship forms between him and, what was her name? I guess her title was Madame de Pompadour, but what was her name?
I am checking here. Lynette.
I was going to say Stan. So
Stan. Okay.
So as the Doctor and Stan keep meeting each other, you know, it's perfect execution of the trickiness of time travel. You know, he's on the other side of this weird portal that's kind of been blown through the universe, and minutes for him are hours or years for her. And it's just, I love all that, but I also love that they introduced, because, I mean, at that point, everybody was used to Rose and Mickey, and Rose is kind of, she's fun, whatever, I'm a blonde girl, I like the Doctor, but now all of a sudden they've introduced a girl who, when he reads her mind, she reads his at the same time, and it completely stuns him, it completely floors him, and it just shows that there's this woman that's kind of on the same level, obviously not on the same level, but is powerful mentally, emotionally, whatever, and it stuns him to the point where he actually, like, steps away from her, and he's like, how'd you do that? And there's metaphors for, you know, a door once open, you can walk through both ways, and that actually comes through later on at the very end of the episode, too. I won't give it away if people haven't seen it, even though it's old. But just beginning to end, rock solid, really, really good. When I think of Doctor Who, that is easily top three for me.
Absolutely.
It's almost perfection. It really, really is. Of course, we've already talked about the monsters and all that, so we'll leave that there. I had a tough time picking a season one episode. I don't know. Obviously, the show was getting off. You know, it was just getting off the ground, and you know, it was finding its footing and stuff. But I really liked what they did with Father's Day. I felt that it was one of those situations where if you could time travel and you could go anywhere, I mean, who wouldn't do that? You know, I thought it actually humanized Rose. I thought it brought, for lack of a better term, a little bit of reality to it. a little bit of realism in that sense, just in a plotting and a character sense. But and I liked, of course, how once you did go back and he said you can't really mess with time, and then all of a sudden these creatures are literally eating time and the people and whatever. And that was fine. That was very Doctor Who-y. But the characters and the growth and the plot was just so good and so heartbreaking. You know, what you have to do and what she ultimately had to do to kind of restore everything and put things back on the right path was just so good. You know, and meanwhile you got Christopher Eccleston, he's doing a great job, and you know, he's being the Doctor, he's being very standoffish, and he's obviously super pissed that she did this and defied him and stuff. But by the end of the episode, while he's still trying to save everybody and himself, you know, he comes around and he realizes what it was like for her, which I think showed a lot of depth for that version of the Doctor, which we've talked about in the past has been kind of this like almost shell-shocked war vet, you know, this survivor of this great war and this, I don't want to say broken, but pretty close. I mean, you know, after the Time War, they kind of wrote him as such a very on-the-edge character, and then he meets Rose and starts coming back and everything. So I liked what they did with him from the beginning to end of that episode, and again, with the time travel and the implications of that, and just the human element of it all. And then flashing forward, I have Vincent and the Doctor from last season, which to me is about as good as Doctor Who gets. I just love it. I love it from the beginning to end. Guest stars notwithstanding, performances notwithstanding, it is a perfect Doctor Who story, in my opinion. Again, forget the monster. If you look just at the Doctor, at Amy, at Vincent, at what happens, at, you know, how they kind of grow, at, you know, how Vincent is treated, how, you know, today he's revered, but you go back to his time and he's being thrown out of bars, and people are like, you know, like throwing his paintings away and mocking him, and it's just so good. It's so good. And it's another one of those stories where, you know, time travel shows such a different angle on things that people really don't think of otherwise. I mean, yeah, you can read in a book that, well, nobody appreciated an artist in his time, but to see an episode of television where it brings it to life in such a believable and moving way, you know, just the actors and everybody did such a fantastic job. And you think it's going to be a pretty decent story, and then you get about halfway through and the Doctor tries to get Vincent out of bed. He tries to get Vincent out of bed, and he's just, his severe psychosis or depression or whatever it was rears its ugly head, and not even the Doctor's speechless. You know, Vincent kicks him out of his room screaming and yelling and crying, and the Doctor literally has no idea what to do. He has no idea what to do. So he leaves, and he tells Amy they're leaving and whatever, and then before they can go, he snaps out of it. Vincent snaps out of it in a clear case of manic depression or whatever it is, and he's fine. And they go about and they do their paintings, and he flirts with Amy and whatever. But I loved what they did with that. I love what they did with his abilities. When the Doctor and they held hands, you know, he could see how he saw color and how he saw life in the universe, and that's why he painted the way he painted, and I thought that was brilliant. I loved how, you know, with the overall arc, Amy had just lost Rory and had no idea she had just lost Rory. And I loved how Vincent could see that. He could see that she was heartbroken or feel it, even though she had no idea. And of course, that ties into the general plot. But as a standalone episode, I thought that was a nice touch for the character. And then what really did it for me is Amy was still so naive. The Doctor saw it coming, you know, from the very beginning. He knew what visiting would do. And Amy goes back to the future or the present, and she's all excited to see, you know, how his life would have changed and everything. And they go back to the Van Gogh Museum, the exhibits, and it's the same story. I think he killed himself soon after they left, or around the same time, and she's crushed and devastated, and you've got a knowing but very sad Doctor kind of like, you know, like giving her that kind of comfort and letting her know that just because, you know, you try to help people, or just because you can go back, doesn't mean things will change, and it's just, it's phenomenal. From beginning to end, it's absolutely phenomenal. I mean, I would be very surprised and very pleasantly surprised to see an episode like that again soon, because to me it's just such a rare treat of just, I would go so far as to call it pretty much perfect Doctor Who.
You know what's really great about it is that it harkens back to the day when Doctor Who was an educational TV program and kind of time traveling, meeting up with these historical figures and kind of telling their story. And it actually reminds me of this TV show that It was a British show on about art, and it was a short run series. I'll have to dig it up. But one of the episodes was about Vincent Van Gogh, and about his his battle with manic depression and I think he was even bipolar as well. And he fought a lot of afflictions, a lot of diseases, and so on. And watching this episode of Doctor Who really showed me, you know, it brought back this earlier TV program, I guess you could say, that I really started to understand who Vincent Van Gogh was. And at the same time, I mean, you watch this episode and you feel just so sorry for him the entire time. You're very sympathetic towards him, and you understand why he does the things he does. And at the same time, it's almost like you want to reach into the screen and help this guy out. Right, you want to be,
yeah.
you want to be the Doctor's companion, just for this one character, just for this one guy, Vincent Van Gogh. And it's interesting how, you hear all these really weird things about his life, and for anybody who studied an ounce of art or knew an ounce of about Vincent Van Gogh, you've heard the stories about him cutting his ear off and being high on absinthe and just kind of being this nutty, crazy, drunk artist. Well, this episode really humanizes it and makes him almost a tragic figure, which Doctor Who does so well with a lot of these characters. And again, because it's historical and it's baked in truth, I think it takes it that one step further. So, I mean, I agree.
Yeah,
I really enjoy this
episode. For sure.
It just pulls at the heartstrings. And I didn't even talk about the monster, the twist with the monster. I mean, you think it's this creature from space that's terrorizing all these people, and then you find out what's really going on. And Van Gogh gets all upset. Yeah. I think he might cry. And it's just, oh man, it's just so good.
Yeah.
I can't praise it enough. And then I think we're only doing three or whatever. But I also had on my list, which I have lost here, The Doctor's Wife.
Yes.
Which was this season. And I think, I know it's still fresh in everybody's minds. But I think it's going to hold up. I really do.
Absolutely.
I really liked it a lot. I think it's already going to go down as one of the more iconic, one of the more memorable, and just straight up one of the better episodes of New Who. They had a lot to do. There was a lot of hype around the episode, who was writing it, who was directing it, what it was going to focus on. And to bring the TARDIS to life like they did is just phenomenal. And to tease other Time Lords, and then to see Matt Smith's reaction throughout the whole episode between excitement and hope and anger and depression and sadness, and then the crushing loneliness again at the end, it was just great. It was a great throwback to what is it now, 40, 50 years of Doctor Who. I mean, it did so much to, as a tribute to the older show, and as a way to keep the newer show going and tie it all together. And, there were hints of older Doctors. There were hints of even David Tennant and the Time War, which hasn't been mentioned almost at all on the new, since Moffat took over. And there was just so much layers and layers and layers just in this episode. And it was just so good. And just, we could probably, if we ever talk about the history of Who or overall essential episodes beyond, these three or whatever, I think we'll come back to this one many times. I really do. I think it's going to go down with Blink or Girl in the Fireplace or Van Gogh or Silence. I really do think it's a top five, top ten episode.
To be fair, there were two episodes that I was going to include in my list, but I didn't, just because I knew somebody else would. One of them was Blink, of course, and then The Doctor's Wife was the other one.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. I think you're always going to have that overlap. I think there are certain episodes that are always going to be on the list.
Right.
All right, so we've got a huge amount of really great episodes here. So I'm just going to go through the list right now and let you guys know which ones we chose as kind of the essential ones, and maybe we can narrow it down to like – it's going to be really difficult to narrow it down to like five or six or so episodes, but you can almost build a season just out of these great episodes. But we have Rose, Blink, The Silence in the Library, and Force of the Dead, Doomsday, Family of Blood, which was, I think that was also a two-parter, Christmas Invasion, Girl in the Fireplace, The End of Time, Doctor's Wife, Vincent and the Doctor. So I think those came up a lot amongst all of us. And that might actually be, I think that's about seven or eight total right there. So it's not a, it's actually not a bad number. I mean, I'm pretty happy with those. Is there any that that we knocked out of contention that we think we should add in?
I don't think so. I think that's a pretty good list, to be honest with you.
Yeah, that could be a really great best of, or it's not even really best of, because there are other really great episodes, but it's best of for catching up to Doctor Who and kind of realizing who the Doctor is. And I think going through these episodes, and what I'll do is I'll put them in chronological order in the post here. I'll break it out into a whole separate post. Let's do that. Let's spread the Doctor Who love out even further. But the fact that you have these just fantastic episodes is enough for somebody to go beyond getting caught up, to the point where you can almost watch any other Doctor Who episode beyond this one, because you do have a couple of really great one-off episodes like Girl in the Fireplace and Blink and Vincent and the Doctor and Doctor's Wife that all tie in just to the overall idea of the Doctor, who is, he's helping people, but in all these different ways, right? And I think the one-offs, to me, almost do it better than any of the other ones in that, again, Girl in the Fireplace, he does the whole time thing where he's shifting from, you know, minutes or hours in his day are months or years to somebody else, and how that plays back and forth. And you have Blink, which is the Doctor's not even there, yet he's solving, he's saving the planet by helping other people kind of figure out their way. And again, playing through the whole time thing as well. Vincent and the Doctor, which was just, again, we just spent a whole time talking about that. And then the Doctor's Wife and his whole relationship to the TARDIS, this humanized TARDIS, and the realization that they chose each other several incarnations in the past, you know. And so I think those as single episodes work really well. But So I'm really happy with this list, guys. I'm in fact to the point where I want to go back and start and kind of rewatch several of these. And we have some. We have at least one from every season, if not two. I think the only one we only have one from is the first season, which is
it makes Rose. Sense.
Yeah, which is right. Understandable. Yeah, but I'm super stoked at this list, guys. I don't know what your thoughts are.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a great list.
Very good.
Yeah, this is an awesome best of list. So, I mean, I thank you guys for putting the time into, digging into your Doctor Who memory banks to pull these out. But I'm sure that the fans of the show, Lonely TARDIS show, and then just new fans to Doctor Who will appreciate this. Maybe we'll even put like the links to Netflix or to Amazon or something to get help people get caught up. With that said, what we normally do is trivia, and again, we're going to do trivia this week. I say normally do because we usually have three people. It's essentially now who's going to yell into my ear the fastest. So, Mike, this is your first time. You've listened to a couple of previous episodes, I'm sure, so you know we do a trivia round for the people that are on our show. Poor Sean is bad. You're 0-2 now, I think, Sean, right? Because you weren't on that first episode. But and you were so close on both times that
I think – we got to be careful. There are some moments where we might need to freeze time and see who said what when. It's close. I keep losing by like half a point. It's driving me crazy.
And I think the problem is what we noticed the last episode, Mike, was that Sean was yelling it split second ahead of everybody else. But because there was lag in Skype, it showed him as being as being too
some
far
bullshit.
Yeah.
Well, you'll be happy to know that I don't do well under pressure. So.
Excellent.
Pressure him.
Well, I'm going to let you guys know that the winner this week is going to get a really awesome prize. And they're going to get – I'm going to post it here in the chat window for you gents. But the winner is going to get a Doctor Who – the Dalek 2 Victory poster, which is based off the – I think it was last season with where the Daleks were kind of reintroduced to Matt Smith era in through World War II. So the winner between you two gets this lovely, lovely poster, 24 by 36. And, you know, I'm going to offer the same thing to the audience. And this is how I'm going to do it. We actually had somebody post in our previous Lonely TARDIS about their favorite, their quintessential episodes. I'm actually going to include them as an automatic entry into this week because they couldn't win last week because they don't have an iOS device. And nobody else posted. Regardless.
Yeah, we got to fix that.
So for this week, we're actually going to hand out something that people can win, which is this Doctor Who Dalek poster. And like I said, you can see the link in the post. Give us your top 3 to 5 Doctor Who episodes. Don't go more than 5. And these are episodes that you think are important to watch if you're if you're green to Doctor Who. If you've never watched a Doctor Who before, I think this is kind of your task, your assignment. So see if you can do that. Post it in the comments, and we will select one at random to be of those who qualify to win this sweet, 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 sexy poster.
Nice.
And I emphasize the sexy part. So with that said, we're going to go to 5 points here. Yes, it's going to be interesting yet again. They're 1 point each, every correct answer. And I'm going to base this week on the questions or on our favorite episodes that we just kind of talked about. So, the first questions: Who placed in the water of Mars? Who placed the virus on Mars?
Oh no!
What? Who placed it there?
Yes.
Oh.
I'm going to read you a quick little clip here, and hopefully you guys can answer. The first person to answer wins. While inspecting the glacier that is the source of the base's water, the doctor surmises that the virus was placed there eons ago by the blank. There's a great big hint in that sense.
Well, I mean, there's a throwback to the old Doctor Who villains, but I don't think – I mean, there's an old Doctor Who wasn't – Didn't they have an old episode with the Ice Warriors or something?
You got it. Well, the Ice Warriors it is. That's the answer.
Really?
Yes, it is the Ice Warriors. It's just one of the alien races, I guess. One of the fictional races. I don't actually remember it. It was
old,
in
old
1967 story, The Ice Warriors, set at a time in the future when the world was in the grip of a new ice age. So, a nice.
It's interesting. I thought he I thought he surmised that they ran from it, but maybe I'm wrong about that.
That sounds, oh man, that sounds familiar, them running from it. I don't know. I don't know nothing about nothing.
You don't know nothing about nothing.
That's because of all the pressure.
Yeah, there you go, all the pressure.
Boom, 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 boom.
In the episode Blink, all right, this is going to be
yes.
An interesting one. What is the name, let's see here. What is the name of the girl that gets the DVD sent to her?
Oh, blah, 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 blah. Sparrow.
No.
Now, see, we've already established that I'm not remembering any names today. so this is going to be awful.
Sarah? Sparrow?
So close.
Susie?
Steven?
So
sexy?
Sally?
You got it. Sally it is.
Ah, oh, you bastard.
Like, guess what? After letting Sean go through all the S's. It is one apiece.
I don't even feel good about that.
You can walk off a bridge. That's what you can do.
All right, let's see here. In the episode Vincent and the Doctor, what was written on the painting? The 12 flowers.
Was that for Amy?
You got it. Nice.
Son of a bitch.
Sean, you better speak up here. You're going to be batting over.
Oh, get the hell out of here. Like I didn't have Sparrow.
All right, let's do this one. In the The Girl in the Fireplace.
Kill myself if I don't get this.
All right, you will clear something. How about this one? Which English king was it?
Oh, King
Lear.
It starts with King. I know that.
Did you say Lear?
Wait. What do you mean English king? They were in France.
Oh, sorry. Which French king?
Louis. Yeah, and you're a bastard.
That was a trick question, King Louis the 14th. Why did I say it was? It's the whole thing took place in Versailles, so or right around Versailles. Anyways, there you go. 2-2.
Very. He was her official mistress.
Oh, yes.
And then Mickey's all like, "How do you think she got on with the Queen?" And she's like, "Oh, they were best friends." And Mickey's like, "Oh yeah."
Ah, chicka chicka.
Wow.
The French.
So, in the episode Blink, what causes the angels to move incredibly fast when observed, but when they are seen, literally turn people to they turn to stone? What's the condition?
It's a defense mechanism.
Temporal defense.
What? What'd you say?
Temporal defense.
No,
but that's just me making shit up.
Yeah. Well, you were kind of close on that.
Well, I know it's a defense mechanism of some sort. Yeah. I didn't know it had a name.
What are they? Are they time locked?
Oh, so damn close! So damn close! So damn.
Sally.
Sally.
English king.
By the way, it was Sally Sparrow. You were right the first time, Sean. So I have to give you a half a point for that. By the way.
Oh no! This is what always ruins me. Yeah, I always so get the half point. Point.
It was Sally Sparrow. So right. I give you a half point. I give Mike the whole point. Okay, the answer was they're quantum locked. Quantum locked is the terminology used for the for their condition.
Time locked.
Yeah, well, quantum locked is a little better. let's go with the very first episode of. Let's see, which doctor should we choose?
I just picture you with a long scroll of just like trivia from every episode of the last 5 years.
It's funny right because there are. I have a Google Doc which I've loaded to the brim with all these. So whatever you guys do, do not look for that Google Doc.
Where is it?
Yeah. All right. And I won't. The problem was we actually answered this question in a way before, but. I have to take a different spin on it. Where did in the very first episode, Rose, where did the Nessian consciousness take up residence, basically?
Underneath the
Ferris
the
wheel.
Ferris wheel.
The giant dish?
The London Eye, isn't it?
You got it, London Eye. Oh, you were so close, Mike. All right, 3.5 for Sean. This is usually where he ends up crashing out.
One can only hope.
Yeah.
I will murder you.
let's see here. I was gonna go back to the Vincent and the Doctor and ask you the condition of the alien and why he was.
He was blind.
He was blind. But that one is—it's almost way too easy.
This is what happens. You take away my points.
I wouldn't have gotten that. Just so you know.
That's okay.
Oh, really?
It's okay. Nope. It's fine. Ask another question.
That's true.
You can just ask it now that I know it.
Go back. Who can scream fastest?
Who can scream fastest?
Go back to your infinite doc. It's fine.
All right, scroll down. What was in Midnight, since Steven mentioned that one, what was the name of the businesswoman that kept repeating the phrase over and over and over again?
Oh. I'm not going to get that.
No, I'm not either.
Donna Noble.
Yeah!
Yeah! You're going to get it. Okay, I'm just going to tell you right out. It was Sky Silvestri.
And,
it was. It's.
I remember what she looked like and how crazy she got.
That is very true. That is very true. Let's move on to The End of Time, which was actually a very great, great episode. This part of the episode was really cool, except that I don't really know how what life would have been like this, but How did the Master plan to take over the planet?
By turning everyone else into the Master.
Everyone, yeah, damn it.
Oh, there you go. You mentioned clones.
No, I was wrong.
Were wrong, and so Mike gets it. So now Mike is at three. Yeah, he essentially turns everybody on the planet into a doppelganger of himself.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is actually kind of a cool way to do it when you kind of think about it. Instead of killing everybody, just turn them into you. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. All right, in The Doctor's Wife, what was the name of the planet that they were on?
House.
Oh, yes.
Was that the name of the planet, or was that the name of the monster? Because the monster wasn't the planet.
That is correct, actually.
Because they called the monster House, and that was when he was in the TARDIS, but the planet was still there.
The planet was still there, but it all kind of dealt with him being the kind of the overall. Damn you.
I'll take my half point.
You'll take your half point, Sean. You're at four. So you would have been at 4.5. At least it got you back up to an even number.
at least.
I'm just
crawling
here to help.
Victory.
Yeah. okay. Yeah, literally crawling to victory. Every way possible is going to be the way to do it. Okay. How about... in the most recent episode, Night Terrors, George, the child, is what kind of child? He's a child of what?
Aliens?
What's
the name of it? The race.
I just watched this today.
Tenors, Tremors, Tellers.
It starts
tevers,
with a T.
Troglivores.
Troglodytes.
River Song. I don't know.
Trogdor.
it does begin with a T.
Talonites. It ends with an ites too, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. You're wrong. It was Tenza.
Tenza.
Tesla.
You were going to say Tanzanite, weren't you?
Tanzanite. Yeah.
Tanzanite. They're controlled by Caribbean gemstones.
Ah, who isn't?
Who isn't? Beautiful. Okay, and you can't really top that early. That's a tough one to go beyond. So we've got to really kind of wrap this up. So I'm gonna start just throwing them out as fast as possible here. Okay, on the episode The End of Time, who did the Master contact to? Let me rephrase that. who came into the play for a short, brief period of time? Let me rephrase it a different way. What was the name of the Supreme Time Lord?
Rassilon.
Was it Rassilon? Was that his full name?
You son of a bitch! I told you that 20 minutes ago.
I would have also accepted the Lord President of the Time Lords too. So
no, it was Rassilon.
But it was
they mentioned it in the second episode.
Yes, that's true. In part
God damn it.
Part two. All right, and here's a question. Hopefully, this is the final question. All right. Let's go with
Timey-wimey.
Let's go with Father's Day.
Oh
fuck.
Yeah, there you go. What is Rose's dad's name?
Ted.
No, because he's in the Pete, because he's in the alternate dimension.
You did it, Sean. Sean breaks the streak. Sean wins 5-4. After I think Sean, you actually answered like 9 questions to get those 5 points, but you win. Mike, we're sorry you didn't make it.
To be fair, the points that I did have were mostly stolen from Sean.
That's true. That's okay.
Sean's actually winning 10-1. I think it was probably closer to what.
Well, if we're keeping score.
Yeah. Well, Sean, you win the awesome prize, and you at home, do you see what I did there? You at home, too, can win this fantastic prize if you tell us
Radio Voice.
Radio Voice, if you tell us what your 3 to 5 quintessential Doctor Who episodes are, and we will mention you on a future episode. Also, again, feel free to email us, lonelytardis@sidequesting.com. And,
tell your friends.
Yeah, and then make sure you subscribe to the new feed, which is located, I'm pointing down, but it means the bottom of this post here. So, everybody, thank you for joining us. Sean, always a pleasure. You've you once again light up our show.
Thank you. I don't you caught me off guard with that one.
You light up our show like an exploding star meant to save Rose Tyler.
So beautiful.
There it goes. There it goes.
You murderous Time Lord bastard. They can find you at what's your Twitter handle?
So you can find me on Twitter at Sean, S-H-A-U-N, Norton, N-O-R-T-O-N, all one word, Sean Norton.
All one word. Mike, where can we find you? You actually have a brand new podcast that you guys have started up.
I sure do. Yeah.
Which I've been listening to, and I could not control myself from laughing that hard at work today.
I was wondering where that was going.
Yeah, I could not control myself. My pants are
just couldn't control myself.
What podcast is this? I like to lose control.
It is A Fistful of Pixels. We've got Twitter, which is at Fistful of Pixels, and you can also find the podcast at bit.ly/A Fistful of Pixels.
And give a quick synopsis of what your show's about.
Basically, what we do is we take everyday phrases, either we generate them by the internet, or more and more we're trying to use listener-submitted phrases, and then we spend a few minutes brainstorming a video game idea on that phrase, and what ends up happening is a mix between improv comedy and game development.
You have to say, Sony, Nintendo, Microsoft, just listen to this show, you'll come up with a bajillion ideas. They're all there. What was there was like a porn one you guys had this week, and then there was something about a lumberjack that was included as well.
Sensual Jackhammer 3D.
Sensual Jackhammer 3D, that was a good one, yeah. So great job. And where else can they find you? Is it at...
It's at the Mike Bachman, if you're looking for me.
There you go. And I am Dally Domofsky at Coolrats, KEWLRATS. And you can find Steven Strom on Twitter at Steven Strom, not Steven Storm. Although we could make a fake Steven Storm name and probably make it really cool. Anyways, thank you everybody for listening to The Lonely TARDIS. We are whisked away. I don't even know what that means, but bye.
Oh, you got to leave that in the episode now.
I am. I'm leaving the episode. Thanks, everybody. See ya.
Later.